Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. When I received an advanced copy of the new book, Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battlefield of the Cold War by Jeff Schessel, I was both interested and a little dubious. The story of the Mercury astronauts has been told and retold over the years in books, film, and television, most notably by Tom Wolfe in his classic 1979 book, The Right Stuff, and the film adaptation that came out of that in 1983. But upon reading it, I discovered, as the author himself did, that there were many untold and undertold stories about the Mercury astronauts and the space race that was being led by the Soviet Union from the launch of the first artificial satellite, Sputnik, in 1957 until the Gemini and Apollo missions hit their strides in the latter half of the 1960s. Schessel was a speechwriter for former President Clinton, and it shows in his skill constructing a narrative centered around the life of John Glenn, who was the most famous of the first group of seven astronauts from the very start and ever after, and how that came to be is a fascinating part of the story. Schessel joined me recently to talk about the book and how the story resonates today, with the U.S. once again finding an adversary, this time China, forging ahead with a robust space program. Jeff Schessel, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks very much.
Before we get into your book, I'd like to know a little more about your background. You were a speechwriter for President Clinton, right?
I was indeed. I was his deputy chief. I was there for the second term.
And you were a lead writer for some of the State of the Union addresses, I believe?
I was. That is, of course, a classic written by committee speech. Yeah. Just about everybody has a hand in one of those. But yeah, I did get to have a pretty big hand in it.
So as a huge fan of the West Wing, since you actually did that, you know, how realistic are the characters of Toby and Sam Seaborn as the speech writers for the president?
You know, well, of course, we're all much better looking than Rob Lowe, all of us speechwriters.
Of course.
Yeah. Other than that, the portrayal was pretty accurate in a lot of ways. And in fact, we got used to seeing those guys around the West Wing. They did a lot of what I guess for them is research. They came by and they talked to a lot of us about our jobs, and they weren't trying to, you know, create a mirror image, obviously, of our reality, but they did want it to echo at least the way things actually worked. And so I think we all felt a kind of connection to the show in those early years when it did actually have that resonance with the Clinton White House. And then, of course, the show evolved and our administration was over. So things went in different directions.
Yeah, well, that was my favorite period of the show. Rewatching it all these years later, it's fascinating how a lot of the same issues are this, you know, the issues we're dealing with today, only the phones just look a lot different.
They sure do. So do the cell phones.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's talk about your book. I'm really interested to find out what compelled you to get interested in doing a book about Project Mercury and John Glenn, because it seems to me like, you know, on first glance, that this is a topic that's been hashed over many times in books and movies and television shows. What made you interested in doing this?
Well, and I had thought so too. I was always fascinated by the story, and I love those books and movies, and I still do. And I wasn't sure that there was something new to be added, but I'm gratified to say now, on the other side of this process, this project, that there very much is. And what I was looking for were answers to a couple of questions that occurred to me as I watched those movies, as I read those books. It never really seemed to me that calling Glenn, as many of these pop cultural tributes of one kind or another do, calling him a Boy Scout, calling him a Sunday school teacher, could really explain how this guy was capable of these incredible achievements. There had to be more to him than that. But I wasn't seeing it, and I wasn't reading it. And so I went looking for it, and I was gratified, and maybe we'll talk about this, but I was gratified to find it, that he really is a complex individual. He really was a three-dimensional character, not this sort of two-dimensional hero, as he's so often portrayed. He was edgier. He was more interesting. He was more ambitious. He was more fiercely competitive, and whether that was within Project Mercury or whether it was as a fighter pilot in World War II or Korea. This was a guy who was willing to take profound risks even more than many of the others around him. So that was part of what drew me into it. But I also wanted to understand why, frankly, why his flight was such a big deal. I knew that it was a big deal. He was the first American to orbit the Earth. But on the other hand, he wasn't the first American in space. Al Shepard was. And he wasn't the first person to orbit the Earth. Two Russians had done it before Glenn. So why was this flight so big? It was clear that it was. I mean, 4 million New Yorkers came out in the streets in the biggest demonstration since the end of World War II. 4 million people, many of them weeping, literally weeping in the streets, people climbing bridges and climbing out of windows to see Glenn's motorcade. What was all of that about? And so the answer that I came up with as I began to think more about this and research more about it, is that you can't separate this story, as many do, from its Cold War context. We know that we were competing against the Russians, but by calling it a space race, it sounds like the Olympics. It sounds like a kind of good-natured, good-spirited contest. But this was understood at the time by Glenn, by President Kennedy, by most Americans, and frankly, across the free world, as an existential struggle. In 1960, when John Kennedy ran for president, he said, if the Soviets control space, they can control Earth. That was what was at stake as they understood it. And that story, I felt, had not sufficiently been told.
Yeah, and when you put it in that context to think about it, if you go back to October 1957 and the launch of Sputnik, the first satellite, that really rocked this country a lot more than I think the Eisenhower administration thought that it would. People were really alarmed by that. And so, you know, as you say, you got 5 years from 1957 to that flight in February of 1962, of Americans feeling like we're behind and threatened.
We were behind, we were threatened, and it was not clear that we were catching up, and it was not clear that we could catch up. There was not the sense here in the U.S. that, well, inevitably, you know, we're going to level the playing field in space. Inevitably, we're going to catch up to the Soviets. There was Sputnik was just, of course, the very beginning of it in October of 57. A month later, they sent a much larger, much heavier object into orbit. It was so heavy, in fact, that scientists were scratching their heads on the front page of the New York Times trying to figure out what technology the Russians had even used to get it up there. We couldn't even understand what it had taken to do that, never mind replicate it ourselves. Then they sent the first animal into orbit, the dog, Laika. Then they sent the first unmanned spacecraft to crash land onto the moon. It was not yet possible to soft land it. They sent the first craft to photograph the far side of the moon, which had never been seen before. It was one thing after another. So that when the Russians finally, in April of 1961, send the first human being into space, Yuri Gagarin, it really just seems like Soviet domination of the heavens is profound and irreversible.
Yeah, well, let's get back to John Glenn for a moment and talk about you. You mentioned his wartime exploits, because I found this really fascinating in your book. He was really a hard charger when it came to flying aircraft in combat. Could you tell us about some of his exploits and what kind of a pilot he was and some of his feats and how almost to the point of recklessness that he was as a pilot?
Absolutely to the point of recklessness. In fact, in Korea, and this is just one example, in Korea, he and his commanding officer were flying in very low, very fast toward an anti-aircraft position, and they took a lot of hostile fire. And his commanding officer said, we got to get out of here, and flew away. Glenn circled back, disobeying orders, to fly again low and fast toward this target because he really believed he was going to be the guy to take it out. And instead, he got a hole blown in the tail of his Panther jet, a hole the size of a basketball. And somehow, improbably, he manages to get this plane all the way back to base in South Korea and posed for photographs with it and was sort of proud of himself. He had a reputation among his fellow pilots there in Korea. They had a nickname for him. They called him Old Magnet Ass, that he attracted bullets. And he attracted them, again, by flying more dangerously low and more dangerously fast than anybody else. He was always willing to take the greatest risks. And so Ted Williams, actually, the famous Red Sox left fielder, was Glenn's wingman in Korea, incredibly enough. And Ted Williams, in later years, thinking back about their time in Korea, he said, "That man, John Glenn," he said, "that man is crazy." And if you look again at Glenn in the newsreels, at Glenn in the movies, you think crazy. I mean, he's as sunny and easygoing as anybody possibly could be. And he was those things. And yet he was also fierce. And that's a side of him that people didn't know.
Well, you used a term. There was a term in your book that I saw that on first glance, I thought, oh, well, that doesn't sound like a good word. It's the word is sniveling to describe something that John Glenn did. Could you explain to us what is meant by that word in the context of the story of John Glenn?
Well, sniveling isn't a great word. You never really want to be accused of sniveling. It had a particular meaning in the military context, and it was somebody who didn't just follow orders, but would try to work the system to get the best flight assignment or anything else that they wanted. And Glenn was a master at this. I mean, he said sort of defensively much later in life, he said, "I never felt that the way to succeed in life was to just sit back and let stuff happen. If you want something to happen, you go out and make it happen," which seems reasonable enough. But it ran counter to a military culture where people were not supposed to self-advocate, to use a 21st century term. And Glenn began doing this from the beginning. And when it looked like he and his best buddy were going to get assigned to flying these big transport planes in World War II, these multi-engine planes just ferrying cargo and troops and things like that. And Glenn considered this to be the unsexiest thing that he'd ever heard of, and he wanted no part of it. And so he went over the head, actually, of the guy just above him to try to campaign to get a slot in a Corsair, one of these great fighter planes. And when his commanding officer found out about it, I really just let him have it. And then ultimately, Glenn somehow gets what he wants. And you can look at Glenn in Korea, and you can look at Glenn in NASA. And time after time, Glenn advocates for Glenn, and he gets what Glenn wants.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us, and we'll continue our conversation with Jeff Schessel. He's the author of the new book, Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. We're back. If you're just joining us, our guest is one of former President Clinton's West Wing speechwriters, Jeff Schessel. He's the author of a new book about the early days of the space program during the height of the Cold War. It's called Mercury Rising and centers on America's third man in space and first to orbit, John Glenn. It's interesting that when you look at the NASA early years and Mercury, and let's get into that, because the seven original Mercury astronauts all have such different personalities, but Glenn really did stand out. And when you look at the press coverage, you could tell that, for example, Life magazine, publications like that, they really glommed on to John Glenn's personality because he was already famous, wasn't he?
He was already famous. He was the only one of the Mercury 7 who was already famous when they were all introduced to the public in April of 1959. Glenn had become famous in 57 as a test pilot. This was after Korea. In those years, he became a test pilot, and he set a speed record flying a Crusader jet from LA to Brooklyn in 3 hours and 23 minutes. And that gave the Navy and the Marines, he was a Marine pilot, it gave them bragging rights over the Air Force. But more than that, it wound up on the front page of every newspaper in the country. Pictures of Glenn emerging from the cockpit, pictures of Glenn on the tarmac with his beautiful family, his wife and two kids. And he got invited to compete on Name That Tune, this game show on CBS. And he did. And he competed for 5 weeks and he won. And he not only won, but he was winning. He became kind of part of American popular culture. He was known to everyone and really a kind of both a adorable and admirable guy. And so 2 years later, when the astronauts appeared at the press conference introduced with great fanfare by NASA, the reporters, their identities had been secret up to that point, the astronauts. And they emerge on the stage and the reporters immediately turn to Glenn. We know this guy. And it wasn't just that they knew him and that he was already famous. It was that he was completely at ease in the spotlight, completely at ease in front of the cameras. And he performed. He was funny. He was sentimental. He talked about his faith. He talked about his family. And the other astronauts, I mean, it's amazing to go on YouTube and watch these clips because you can see this whole press conference. They're uncomfortable. They are unhappy with this. These are fighter jocks, these guys, and none of them has been in front of the cameras. One of them, Gordon Cooper, later described the whole process as an ordeal. And they look like it. They look like they just want to get off this stage. And meanwhile, here's Glenn storytelling and absolutely charming the nation's press, who were already in his corner. And so this is wonderful for NASA and it's wonderful for Glenn in the moment, but it wasn't so great for the other astronauts. And it frankly wasn't great for Glenn's relationship with the other astronauts and begins a division that really never heals.
Yeah, because you wind up with this kind of axis between John Glenn and Scott Carpenter and the rest of the other five. And especially, you know, there's this interesting, and over the years, it's been portrayed in many different ways, very complex relationship and competition between the man who would be first in space, Alan Shepard, and John Glenn. And I'm wondering if you uncovered some interesting things in your research that enlightened you about that relationship and that power structure within the astronauts.
I did. I mean, it's interesting because, of course, every one of the seven wanted to win. They all wanted to be first. Every one of them, as you would expect, these were competitive guys, and they had been successful, all of them, as standout pilots. Every one of them wanted to be the first person in space. And if the Russians beat us to it, then they wanted to be the first American in space. The competition was intense, but it was also clear from the beginning that the standouts in really every respect were Alan Shepard and John Glenn. They were the most impressive pilots, and they were also the strongest personalities. They were the most willing to speak their minds. But they were very, very different personalities. Shepard was kind of an icy and kind of cool guy, and the others gravitated around him because he was kind of cool and because he was kind of edgy. Whereas Glenn was this homespun character from New Concord, Ohio, a town of 1,000 people. He was a scout. He was a Sunday school teacher. And he was also this incredibly decorated combat veteran. But he had already alienated himself from the others. And thankfully, he found a like-minded a pilot in the group in Scott Carpenter. But the others really weren't comfortable with Glenn and resented Glenn. But what's interesting is that while you did have these two groups, Shepard wasn't interested in being the leader of his group. He was interested in being the winner of that competition that I mentioned. And that was where all his energy went, to winning that competition. And he did win it. And he won it for reasons that are probably a little bit obscure even today. The man who made the decision ultimately, Bob Gilruth, who ran the Space Task Group, he never put his reasons on paper. But it's clear from talking to some of the folks who were involved in the process, as I have, and it's clear from reading oral histories and memoirs, that there was a feeling on the part of a number of NASA officials that Glenn needed to be put in his place. They didn't particularly appreciate the extent to which he had this following in the national press. It was useful sometimes to promote the program, but they didn't particularly like the fact that anytime they made a decision, it was filtered through reporters saying, well, what about John Glenn? And so what about John Glenn? They made him the backup. They made him the backup to Shepard, and then they made him the backup again to Gus Grissom. And it was a very, very difficult period for Glenn. As I said before, sniveling, if we'll call it that, had won him really every prize he had ever wanted. And here he was. Everybody expected him to be the first man in space. The public expected it. The press was rooting for it. And he didn't get it. He was the backup. The indignity of that was really painful to Glenn. And it took him a while to kind of shake himself out of his depression.
One of the things about the astronauts is they were such celebrities. They definitely attracted groupies, or what were called the cookies back then, I believe. And of course, there was a lot of playing around going on amongst the, you know, these are fighter jocks, as you mentioned, and there was some philandering going on, I'm sure. This all comes to a head in San Diego in a very famous incident there. And I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit about the insights you gained into that.
Well, you're absolutely right. In the off hours, these astronauts like to spend their time doing what they had done as no-name pilots. I mean, they were standout pilots, but nobody knew who they were. Reporters weren't following them around. And they did what they wanted to do. And they went to bars and they spent time with women who were not their wives. All of them were married. But only Glenn and Scott Carpenter were taking those wedding vows seriously. And Glenn had issued a series of warnings to the other astronauts that this was going to cause real trouble. He really felt that he tried to make clear to them that their private time was not private time anymore, because these were people who were now on the cover of Life magazine. They were seen as role models for American children. They were seen as symbols of the best of America all around the world. And so Glenn told them repeatedly that if any of them got caught and exposed for what they were doing in the off hours in Cocoa Beach and places like that, that it was going to not only hurt them and their families, but it was going to hurt the program and it was going to hurt the country. And he did not have a very willing audience for this set of messages, and they went forward to do whatever they were going to do. And one night in San Diego, they were visiting San Diego in late 1959. They were kind of going on a tour, meeting with officials and meeting with defense contractors who were building the rockets and building other components of the spacecraft. So in the off hours, they did what they did. And Alan Shepard went across the border to Tijuana to a bar with a woman who was not his wife. And he was followed by a photographer and a reporter. And they recorded what they saw, and they were prepared to run this story the next day or the day after that. And when Glenn got word of it, Glenn got on the phone with the editor, with the reporter, and with the publisher of that newspaper. And he made a patriotic appeal to all of them. And he said, look, we're in a race for our national security with the godless communists, was how he put it. And you're going to run this story about, you know, a mistake that one of our guys has made, and you're going to jeopardize the entire program during this nuclear age. And they backed down. They didn't run the story. And you would think then that might actually heal the relationship between Glenn and Shepard, but then Glenn overplayed his hand, and he called all the astronauts together for a meeting at that hotel the next morning, and he let them have it. And he said, this is exactly what I've been warning you about. And the only reason we're not in trouble today is because I took care of it. And this just goes to show everything that I've said all along. Well, you know, that didn't go down particularly well. And Alan Shepard was unrepentant, in fact, angry to be called on the carpet by John Glenn. And the only person in Glenn's corner, again, was Scott Carpenter. So this was one of the sharpest divisions among the group, and it never really healed.
Well, but it does to an extent, because once Shepard is selected for the first flight, and John Glenn is his backup, They do reach some level of detente, if you will. And there's that famous scene where John Glenn puts a sign, and I believe he took the centerfold out of a Playboy magazine and put it into Shepard's Mercury spacecraft, didn't he?
He did. And it does show that Glenn had made his peace with the fact that he was back up and he couldn't do anything about it. He'd actually tried to do something about it. He tried that sniveling again. And after the decision that it would be Shepard was made, Glenn protested the decision and he asked Bob Gilruth to take it back, but he wouldn't. And ultimately Glenn had to accept it. And he was a very loyal backup. He did everything that he needed to do to support Shepard. He was Shepard's eyes and ears through the program. He essentially mirrored every move that Shepard made. He took his phone messages. He made appearances that Shepard couldn't make because Shepard was too busy. And it did kind of bring them together. It was an uneasy alliance, but it did kind of bring them together. And in a final, I mean, it's a funny peace offering, if you can call it that. But as you said, Shepard arrived at the capsule the morning of his flight, and Glenn, in his role as backup, had been there early to kind of check out the capsule, make sure everything looked all right. And Glenn had indeed put a centerfold in there, which is a very un-John Glenn thing to do. So that's why it's kind of in a perverse way, a gesture of conciliation to Shepard. And he left him a little sign with some inside jokes. And Shepard got a huge kick out of it. And then they closed the hatch and Shepard went on his way.
Yeah. And fascinatingly, you know, through all this, and John, it's very apparent in your storytelling that John Glenn's having a very difficult time not being first. And it really takes him. In fact, I think you recall one of his neighbors having to have a talk to him on the front lawn saying, you know, knock it off, man, you're bringing everybody down. But in the long run, he does wind up being the winner. Because I can remember as a kid in the 60s, who was the most famous astronaut? John Glenn. And it's because of the flight that would happen in February of 1962. So let's talk about that, because there was a huge buildup to that. And there were several attempts to get that flight off. I believe the first was on the 16th of January, and then again on the 20th. They had scrub after scrub and delay after delay. Could you talk a little bit about what you learned about the difficulties they had before finally Friendship 7 got off the ground?
It was a very protracted and very difficult period filled by a lot of postponements. But before I talk about those, I just want to go back to the first comment that you made, and that is about Glenn's incredible luck in getting the first orbital flight, the big one. That's what everybody called the orbital flight, the big one. And yes, initially they were all competing to be first, but then the competition shifted who was going to get to be the first American to orbit the Earth, because that was going to be the flight that created the feeling that we were catching up to the Soviets. Alan Shepard's flight and then Gus Grissom's shortly after that were what are called suborbital flights. This is what Jeff Bezos is about to take in July, by the way.
On New Shepard,
you know, which is not a coincidence. It goes up and it comes down. The whole thing was over in 15 minutes because the rocket wasn't powerful enough to push the capsule into orbit. The American rockets that were powerful enough were just not ready yet. They had a terrible habit of blowing up on the launch pad. So Glenn, actually, when he came up third in the rotation, he was supposed to take another one of these suborbitals. And it had just become, frankly, too embarrassing for NASA. They called them short shots. And by this point, the Soviets had orbited two people around the Earth, one of whom, the second, Termin Titov, for 24 hours. Yeah. Gagarin went around once. Titov went around 17 and a half times. So the U.S. seemed to be falling farther and farther behind. So there was an understanding that we need to shift to the orbital phase, whether we're ready or not. And they were never going to be as ready as they wanted to be. And so Glenn came up in the rotation, and there was a myth that began then, and actually I hear it still, that NASA was holding him back for the big one. Because, of course, he was the greatest of the astronauts, so they were saving him. There was no discussion like that within NASA. There was a lot of luck to it, and it was big luck because the stakes of this flight were significant from the start, and they only grew during that protracted period that you mentioned where it was delayed Over 4 months, it was delayed 10 times. It was delayed time and again for technical reasons. There were problems with the rocket. There were problems with the capsule. There were problems with Glenn's spacesuit. It was leaking oxygen. And there were problems with the weather, which were going to make it impossible for him to splash down safely. And so it was one thing after another. And it really started to feel during this dangerous period when the Soviet Union was becoming more and more belligerent in Berlin and in other parts of the world, that the U.S. was never going to get a guy into orbit and that something terrible inevitably was going to happen to John Glenn. And even John Glenn started to feel that way.
Yeah, in fact, he writes some notes and some things that you ran across for his family that I found really kind of chilling and fascinating. He really thought there was a good possibility he was not going to survive this flight, didn't he?
He did, and that was one of the real surprises for me, because when you look at the public record, Glenn was very calm. He was very confident. In fact, at one point, President Kennedy calls him to the Oval Office and says, "Is this safe? Is this going to be okay?" And Glenn says, "Yes, Mr. President, you know, this is absolutely safe. NASA's done everything that it needs to do." But privately, and this was the surprise, privately, Glenn was as worried as anybody else. And this document that you mentioned was, to me, the greatest surprise in what I found at the Glenn Archives. What it was he had written a script for a recording that he made on a reel-to-reel recorder for his kids, who were teenagers. He had two kids, Lynn and David, and a separate recording for his wife. And these were recordings that would be played for them if he didn't come back alive. And it begins on a really chilling note. As you said, it begins, "If you hear this, I've been killed." And he says, "Let's talk about the funeral." And he talks to his kids about how he wants them to conduct himself at Arlington National Cemetery for a funeral where there probably wouldn't be a body to bury. I mean, it's very, very frank and very moving stuff. He talks about his belief in God and his belief in an afterlife. And he even talks about a signal that he wants to send to his children from heaven so that they'll know that he's there and that he's okay. I mean, it's very intimate stuff, and it's very moving to read. And incredibly, just before Glenn finally lifts off on February 20th, 1962, he's strapped into that capsule, sitting on top of that Atlas rocket. It's already rumbling. It's about to take off. And he says goodbye. He's patched through, says goodbye to his wife, Annie. And one of the last things that he says to Annie is, "Did you get the recordings that I sent you?" This is very much on his mind.
Wow. Yeah, I'd never known about that till I read that in your book. That's fascinating. And like I said, kind of, gave me the shivers when I read that. Let's take a brief break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Jeff Schessel, the author of the new book, Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our guest is Jeff Schessel. He was a speechwriter in the West Wing for former President Clinton and the author of a new book about the early days of the Cold War space race with the Soviet Union. It's called Mercury Rising, and it focuses on the role that John Glenn played during the time when America was desperately trying to catch up with the Russians in spaceflight. And, you know, people don't realize how dangerous this was. I mean, we know from the space shuttle disasters of Challenger and Columbia that, you know, space flight is dangerous, and the near disaster of Apollo 13. But these early flights were especially dangerous.
they were especially dangerous, and this one more than the first two. Shepard and Grissom rode up on a Redstone rocket, which was known as Old Reliable. It was seen as a pretty safe rocket as these things went. People were worried for sure, but not that worried. But Glenn was riding this really unpredictable Atlas rocket, and it just had a terrible track record. And so that was problem number one. And then assuming that the liftoff is safe, then he's in space. And there are all sorts of other things that can go wrong in space. And in fact, this is something that I hadn't appreciated because, of course, we all know that he got back safely. We know the end of the story. But what I hadn't realized until I spent time doing this work is that, so Glenn orbited the Earth three times. And the first orbit went very well. But at the end of the first orbit, a couple of things went wrong. One was that the autopilot started to have problems and the capsule started to skate out of alignment. If you think of it like a car, and then the thrusters would kick it back into line and then it would drift again. And then the thrusters would kick in again, and it was burning a lot of fuel doing this. So Glenn had to turn off the autopilot and take over manual control, which he knew how to do and actually was kind of eager to do. So that was a problem, but not a huge problem from Glenn's view. But the other thing that happened around the same time was that a warning light went on at Mercury Control in Cape Canaveral. And what it said was that Glenn's heat shield had started to separate a little bit from the capsule, which it was supposed to do just before splashdown to cushion the blow, but it wasn't supposed to happen in space. Because if it wasn't tightly bound to the capsule, then it wasn't going to protect him against the 3,000 degree heat of re-entering the atmosphere. And so, in fact, if this was true, then Glenn would be incinerated on the way back. And so at Mercury Control, they spent the last two of Glenn's three orbits in a total panic and in a really difficult debate about whether to trust that signal or whether, in fact, the signal was the problem. That turned out to be the case in the end, but they didn't know that. So they were trying to devise plans by which Glenn could come back safely, but they were also trying to do it without telling Glenn. Chris Kraft, the flight director, made the decision that Glenn should not be told about any of this because they thought he would panic, which is really underestimating a guy who was chosen for this role precisely because he's not a guy who panics in dangerous situations. But they wouldn't tell him. Instead, they began to ask him leading questions so they could try to figure out whether this was a legitimate problem. They had one point, and keep in mind, Glenn at this point is in orbit around the Earth, more than 100 miles above the surface of the Earth. And Mission Control says, John, do you hear any banging noises?
That's not what you want to hear. You don't want to hear a question like that.
No, you really don't. And then they offer no explanation. And then finally, at the very end of his flight, after a whole series of these kinds of questions, they tell him to fly to re-enter the atmosphere with something called the retro pack strapped on. It was supposed to jettison before you come in. They thought that leaving it strapped on would hold the heat shield in place. They weren't sure. And so they tell him, leave this in place. And never in 2 years of training has anybody ever talked about doing anything like that. And so Glenn finally cracks and he says, is there a reason for this? What is the reason? And the answer is, not at this time. That's their answer. Is there a reason for this? Not at this time. There's no reason. And so he has to come in knowing that something is dangerously wrong. It probably has to do with the heat shield. And the retro pack, because it's not designed to come through the atmosphere, begins to melt and catch fire, and chunks of it are coming apart and banging into the capsule as he's coming back through the atmosphere. And Glenn, for a period of time, is worried this is the heat shield and that he only has seconds left to live because they hadn't told him what was going on. And, he came back to parades and all sorts of celebrations, but within the walls of NASA, there were some heated discussions about this after the fact.
Yeah, and did that cause any kind of change in policy going into the future about, letting the astronaut pilots know?
Not a wholesale change in culture. There was a little bit more of an open exchange with the astronauts subsequently, but not completely, because you had a culture on the ground, particularly under the leadership of Chris Kraft, that only Mission Control had all the variables in front of it, which was true in a sense. I mean, they had all of this telemetered data that was coming at them from tracking stations around the world. And the astronaut couldn't possibly keep track of all this. The astronaut couldn't do what they're doing on the ground, which is looking at wiring diagrams to figure out whether it's this switch or that switch. All that being said, it isn't a binary choice where either the astronaut's in control and the ground is in the dark, or the reverse. And so it was about correcting the balance. Over time, it became clear that these astronauts were going to have to fly their own craft, that you couldn't, especially when you're going to the moon, you can't just control that from Florida, that you have to pick the pilots who can do this. And they had chosen them from the beginning. The Mercury 7 were all the most capable pilots that they could find, but they weren't yet trusted by the folks on the ground.
Well, and I think it's also, to be fair, you know, spaceflight is literally being invented as they go along, because nobody's ever done this before.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that cliche of building the plane while you're flying it, that is literally the case here. And every one of, and we talk about these guys being test pilots and then becoming astronauts. Well, were they were still test pilots. These were test flights, every single one of them. And every flight was absolutely from top to bottom and from every angle completely examined before the next flight would go, because they were applying these lessons in real time. And so every Mercury launch was a test flight. And all of this was a set of building blocks toward Gemini. And all of Gemini was a set of building blocks toward what it was going to take to get people to the moon. So they were learning on the job.
Yeah. Okay, let's shift from Florida to Washington, D.C. and the White House and talk about President Kennedy. Because by the end of 1963, you know, we see a John F. Kennedy who's fully embracing, you know, the Mercury astronauts. He's given us the goal to go to the moon before his famous statement to Congress there in May, just right after Alan Shepard's flight in 1961. And the famous speech at Rice, Texas, "We choose to go to the moon," that one. So we think of him as being, you know, this leader in the race to the moon. But that was a real evolution, because when he first came in, he wasn't too sure about the space program and what to do with it, was he? Can you talk about what you learned about the evolution of John F. Kennedy's White House in terms of Project Mercury?
Well, it's helpful to go back to the campaign in 1960 for a moment. Kennedy had run on many things, but one of the things he ran on was closing the gap in space. Part of his mantra was that the United States could not afford to be second in space, that it was dangerous to be second in space, particularly because of how that was perceived around the world. One of the things that Kennedy was aware of was a phenomenon that was called satellite pessimism. And the feeling around the world, and there were all sorts of Gallup polls and other polls that made this clear, that both America's allies and adversaries thought that the nation that was leading in space would be leading in every other respect. And so when you asked people in Britain and you asked our allies in France and West Germany, which country, the U.S. or the Soviet Union, would be leading militarily in 10 years, overwhelmingly they said the Soviet Union. And one of the main reasons for this was the prowess of these Soviet rockets and what they were able to do in space. So Kennedy understood that space was a powerful symbol and that the United States really had to engage, but he didn't have a plan. It was not an area where he felt particularly he needed to have a plan during the campaign. It was just useful as a kind of a mantra, as kind of a slogan. So when he gets to office, when he enters office at the beginning of 61, he asks his, during the transition actually, asks his science advisor, a guy named Jerome Wiesner, to take a look at NASA and to take a look at Project Mercury. And the report that Wiesner comes back with is really bleak. And he says, NASA has no leadership, it's a mess, morale is very low, Project Mercury is way behind, and frankly, it's such a disaster that he advises Kennedy to begin distancing himself from Mercury. He said, you don't want this to be your problem. And maybe you need to cancel the whole thing, because it would be worse, frankly, to have one of these guys die at the top of a rocket. And Kennedy doesn't take that advice, but he doesn't do anything particularly else. And it's not until Yuri Gagarin orbits the Earth in April of 1961 that suddenly the challenge rises to the top of Kennedy's list of issues he has to address. And he sort of flies into a period of activity about this and puts Lyndon Johnson in charge to try to figure out how we are going to, as Kennedy writes Johnson a memo and says, how are we going to get dramatic results that will allow us to win? And the answer that Johnson already knew was that we would go to the moon. And people have been talking about it for some time, but nobody particularly seriously outside of NASA. But Johnson understood that we weren't going to catch the Soviets in the short term. But if we picked a long-term goal that was going to require a decade's worth of investment, that was going to require a decade's worth of research and development, that maybe we would have a chance of leapfrogging the Soviets on the way to the moon. That was the theory. He sold it to Kennedy, and Kennedy went and gave that first speech in May 61, where he said that the nation should commit itself to sending a man to the moon by the end of the decade and bringing him safely back to Earth.
Yeah. And then, of course, the story of John Glenn, it doesn't end with Friendship 7. NASA decides that basically they don't want to take a chance on him flying again. And then he goes into his career in politics. But one of the things I loved about your book was, he does finally get to fly again. He gets to go into space again. And again, he finagles his way into that. Could you just briefly tell us about that before we go?
He does. Well, he's at that point in around 96, 97, he's a fourth term U.S. senator from Ohio. And he's doing some research, just coincidentally, maybe not. He's doing some research on the effects of aging. And it occurs to him that NASA has this complete data set on everything about him from the period from 1959 to 1962. And that perhaps it would be interesting, he thinks, to send him at age 77 back into space to see what the effects of aging are on spaceflight, because you can compare John Glenn 1962 with John Glenn 1998, as it turned out. And he brings some experts together. He makes his case to Dan Golden, who is the administrator of NASA. The matter is brought to my old boss, President Clinton. And ultimately, everybody signs off. Glenn, by the way, I should add, there's only so much finagling and sniveling you can do if you can't pass the test. But Glenn passed every physical test that was required of the younger astronauts who were going on the mission. He's a pretty fit guy at age 77. And so he got to fulfill his dream of going back into space. In October of 1998, he went up on the shuttle.
One of the things I find interesting about this story is, having lived through it myself back in the 60s and the Cold War and what it was like to do drop drills and worry about nuclear annihilation, is that so much of this really is part of that Cold War mentality and the race to see, whose system is best, the United States or, the Soviet Union's at that time. And now I find this story resonating with me as we're involved in a competition again, it seems, with China becoming a power in space and, flexing their muscles. And, in this country, we're just now starting to get our private sector space missions going with SpaceX and Blue Origins and things like that. I'm wondering, what do you think about how this story, reflects about what's going on today and where we are in space today?
I think the parallel is very profound, it's felt in all kinds of ways. But it is ultimately, as you said, it is a test of two systems. That's how it was understood in the early space age, in the early 1960s, that this wasn't just a test of NASA versus the Soviet space program. This was a test of two systems. And there was a lot of doubt in the United States, and in fact, across the free world, about democracy's ability to meet the test. Democracies are divided. They tend to be slow moving. There are a lot of stakeholders with a voice in the process. Whereas a totalitarian system can decide that it is going to apply all its energies in a particular area, and it just does so. And that is a kind of conversation that we have right now with respect to China. I mean, we're arguing right now about whether we're going to do anything about our crumbling infrastructure in this country, whether we're going to rebuild bridges that are failing and so forth. China just does it. And you often hear here in Washington a sense of, in a way, envy of an autocratic system. Nobody wants that, I should think, or I should hope. But they envy the ability of an autocracy to act. And China, Beijing, simply decides that they're going to build a bunch of new roads or build a new city, and they just do that. And that applies to the space program as well. And so this is why it is unnerving, if you are concerned about these things, and I think many people are, to see a Chinese lander on Mars, just right on the heels of our own, to hear of China's plans to send people to the moon on a timetable that is more accelerated than our own. And there is the sense, again, that the space race is heating up. And it is not, again, just about national pride or national prestige, but it is about the ability to control space. China has also invested very heavily in what are called counter space capabilities, which is an analyst's way of describing simply the ability to knock out our satellite systems. They can destroy or disable our satellite systems. And they and Russia, by the way, have invested very heavily in their ability to do that. And the United States here, again, is playing catch up. And it's a dangerous situation when you think about how much of our activity here, from our communications to our national security, depend on our satellite systems. And so the parallel, it's not a reach. This is a contest for high stakes. And it happens, in the upper atmosphere and in low Earth orbit and quite conceivably beyond that.
Well, Jeff Shessel, I really enjoyed reading your book, and which was kind of neat, because when I first saw what the topic was, my initial thought was, well, gosh, I already know this story backwards and forwards. What am I really going to get anything out of this? And I really did. I really, there were a lot of fun things that I learned, and it was just, it's a good read. So bravo, and thanks for giving me something fun to read.
Thanks so much, Dave. That's great to hear. And thanks for having me on the program.
Thanks once again to our guest, Jeff Shessel. You can find his new book, Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War, at most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio, in beautiful and talented and very dry Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.